The Standing Committee of Tynwald on Constitutional and Legal Affairs and Justice is reviewing the ministerial system of government of the Isle of Man. On its webpage, it states that the committee wishes to understand the effectiveness of the change over from a board system of governance in 1986 to a ministerial system of government, which remains in place today. So far, the committee has heard plenty of evidence to suggest that in good times, Council of Ministers works very effectively, but when circumstances are difficult, Comyn has struggled to take the tough decisions. On agenda this evening, we hear part of the evidence given by Chief Minister Alf Cannon to committee members Tanya August-Phillips, Stu Peters and Laurie Hooper.
So, obviously, you started in Manx politics in 2011, so you will have seen three administrations now. Over that period of time, how do you see the ministerial government having worked, and how has it evolved and changed over the course of those three administrations that you've experienced?
So it's definitely been, each administration has had its definite challenges. Obviously the first administration under Alan Bell, there was a significant change in the island's fortunes, literally, in terms of the VAT renegotiation and the impact that that had on government finances. And that interlinked obviously with the financial crash itself presented a huge number of challenges for the government of the day, both in terms of adjusting public spending, but also dealing with the fallout and the social fallout, I think, in terms of the numbers of people unemployed, the shrinkage in the economy, and the adjustments to the way public funds were being spent. So that was the critical issue for that administration. Obviously, under Howard Quayle, we had, a more stable first 4 years in terms of trying to correct the position and the outcomes that have been delivered by the previous administration. Not to say that they were all bad, but there were clearly a number of things that, standing afresh politically, that you wanted to try and change. But then, of course, we had the COVID crisis, which presented a whole raft of different challenges. And of course, this administration has dealt with its own both fallout from that, but other external influences and internal influences that have created a huge number of challenges. So each actually of the administrations in their own way have had something more challenging to deal with over the last sort of 15 years than arguably what had gone on before. I was actually struck by, this sort of sense that between 86, when the first ministerial system first came into play, the growth actually during my father's time and Sir Miles Walker's time, which had been seen in terms of the finance sector, the regulation of the finance sector, the number of businesses that were attracted to the island, and of course that growth in our VAT revenue share, driven very much by that growth in the finance sector. But of course, it strikes me there's almost been two very distinct periods between 86 and sort of 2006, 2007, and the last, nearly 20 years or so, the second half, if you were looking at it, of the ministerial system, where the island's been dealing, I think, with a different set of challenges driven by the outcomes that we saw in that sort of 2007 to 2009 period.
I think it's a fair comment actually to say each government has had its own particular challenges, but it is fair to say they've all faced something pretty critical that's coalesced around them. We've heard before that actually the ministerial system is quite a good system when it comes to allocating money. So when you're doing positive, good things, it's relatively effective as a system to do that, because you've got individual concentrated kind of responsibility, you've got a collective council of ministers that is good at that. But when it comes to dealing with the responding to some of those critical issues and some of those crises, it's a system that we've heard finds it slightly harder to do that, to make those sort of unpopular or difficult choices. Is that something that you've seen over the course of you're a backbencher, you're a minister, you're now chief minister, is that something you've seen from all those perspectives, that when it comes to the ministerial system, as a system being able to respond to those crises, those critical issues, do you think it's an effective system for doing that?
I think it's a fair observation that, clearly, dealing with any difficult decisions actually politically is tough. I wouldn't just extend that, you know, from the council of ministers. I'd extend that, of course, into Tim Ward as well. I think there are some flaws within that in terms of reaching the decisions that are necessary in such a way that, one, the reasoning behind reaching that decision is clearly communicable and understandable, and then having the resolution to stand behind that decision as well, often under quite heavy attack then, which is likely to come from your colleagues in Tim Ward or possibly from other positions outside. So yes, it can be difficult to reach the tougher decisions without having those watered down or diluted or indeed not getting through council.
In a situation where the Chief Minister has maybe vetoed his ministers, could the Chief Minister then expect their support on that issue, that he's vetoed and publicly gone out and said, I had to veto this decision that was made by five of my ministers because it's the wrong thing to do? When that comes to Tim Ward, does the Chief Minister then count on the support of those ministers under collective responsibility, even though it's publicly acknowledged that they all disagree with him? And then if that vote then subsequently fails in Tim Ward, does that fall on the Chief Minister himself or herself to take full responsibility for that outcome? I'm just a little curious as to how, when you're going out and saying we need to break with collective responsibility, which I've got no issue with in principle, actually, it's just when you break that, suddenly a lot of other questions then arise as to, well, what are the consequences of taking a slightly more open approach to doing government and taking a step back from this, the government line is thus.
Yeah, I mean, it does, that potentially does create issues. I've got no... I think it's a fair analysis that you're making that as a risk, absolutely a risk potentially. So if you're challenging the current sort of status quo of the system, you're either of the view it's working well and actually for all its flaws it does the job, or you take the view actually, you know, the system can be enhanced. And, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of examples of controversial government policies that have come through, not just in this administration but others, which have clearly caused a lot of consternation. You know, maybe a 5-4 split in the council of ministers, right? So let's just take that 5-4 split, that, you know, and I'm sure even my predecessor Howard Quayle would get very concerned, as I do, if you've got a 5-4 split on a subject. That's really not a healthy position to be in. So you might put some parameters around it, for example, around how such a mechanism could and when such a mechanism could be used, and or, you know, routes for that to work, play out. You know, but yes, there potentially are consequences. I think a 5-4 is probably, let's say, you know, 8 ministers agree. I mean, would the Chief Minister use that sort of power in those circumstances? I think he or she would then be clearly concerned that they're not got the ability to go to Tim Ward and explain themselves and potentially survive a vote, which then might start causing questions about their leadership. So it would be, I mean, I'd put it into the context of another judgment call, and I'd probably go to that issue of around maybe, you know, powers to direct, etc. Arguably that is the same type of principle that you've just alluded to, in terms of just had to direct that minister to do something. Is the relationship with them and the Chief Minister, or the relationship with them and the council, where it should be at this particular time, and or what other issues are at stake? Because you then, as you will well know, start questioning things like, is the executive within that department functioning properly? What's caused the issue for it to fall out of line to such a point where somebody's gone, I direct you to do this, depending on the scale of the issue, of course.
It's interesting to think about how that would interact with the individual election then of individual members, because in the UK, like you rightly alluded to, you know, the Prime Minister can fall back on, they're all on the same party, they're all on the same manifesto, it's quite straightforward to see where the accountability lies. But when you've got a situation where you'll be going back out to the electorate saying, oh, I know that I was Minister for Education, but that wasn't really my policy, I was directed to do that, or the Chief Minister threatened a veto if I didn't do what he told me, all of a sudden, you start to get much greyer as to who who was actually responsible for that decision. Because like you say, the chief minister, the power would probably be used more often in the breach. It's a soft power. I will veto this if you do it, rather than getting to the stage of needing a veto. So you're giving ministers almost a get-out clause at re-election time. Anything good was their job. Anything bad was ultimately the chief minister's responsibility. It seems like you're setting future chief ministers up for a fall.
It's not something that I would just suggest. I mean, I do think that if the results of this committee are to think actually there are some improvements that we need to make, actually this central piece is quite critical to that overall performance. I think perhaps if I can just sort of add, this also perhaps reflects in terms of the capabilities of government to deliver things like efficiency programs, for example, where of course you are still relying effectively on the goodwill of chief officers particularly to buy into that program and to go with it, and indeed the ministers as well, because effectively you've got, as it stands at the moment, they're effectively departments or ministers by name and by law. Effectively they are effectively the department, but that stream runs right through even the executive. And when you look at it, the Council of Ministers and its performance, that underneath piece as well, that sort of the direct reports, if you like, in terms of the chief executive officers and chief officers, it's quite fundamental. I mean, we've tried to take steps to give the chief executive officer a bit more power this administration. But, I think this piece of this complete tunnel separation is in terms of just figuring that out to get better outcomes, is also sort of a piece of critical thinking, and how whether that sort of central control from an operational perspective and the role of that chief executive officer would also feed in, I think, partly to the effectiveness of the Council of Ministers. We have tried to seek ways to improve that, but that's also quite critical as well.
We've talked a bit about the role of the Chief Minister. Do you think that there is any scope for the selection process for ministers to be reformed, or do you think the Chief Minister being able to ultimately hire and fire at will, is that appropriate in the context we have, or do you think there's any way that could be improved or changed? For example, in the states of Jersey, the states are the ones that have to ratify appointments to ministerial positions. Anything around that kind of space?
That position was, if my memory serves me correct, was in fact the case, was it not, that Tinwood was electing the ministers and in the end I think decided to absolve that responsibility to the chief minister in order to make sure that they were effectively then not conversely hiding behind Tinwood appointees in terms of the overall performance of the Council of Ministers. I think it works relatively well at the moment in terms of overall. I mean, I think if Tinwood were appointing, it would be another complication. I'm not sure what that would solve in terms of delivering better outcomes, and I think that's the critical piece, isn't it, in terms of trying to figure all this out, is, how can Council of Ministers, how can we be sure, and I've sat on the backbenches as well, so I'm not speaking just purely from a ministerial perspective, but how can you be in a position whereby actually you've improved outcomes in terms of performance from that, the council who are ultimately delivering on either the commitments made by Tinwood or sort of commitments that have been made by a consensus government that has come into place post election and has to itself deliver that sort of consensus mandate then that is put together post the election. And that's why, I guess, when you're saying, well, how can the public be clear that actually the Council of Ministers is now doing what we probably want to happen. And a part of that trust is delegated completely, of course, to the MHKs, who are asked to vote in vote in, sorry, for the chief minister, who then appoints the collective council to deliver that consensus. But of course, I would potentially argue that that delegation of vote then for the chief minister, who he or she will have already given some outline in their manifesto as to what sort of direction they want for the government to go, is actually quite a critical vote, because, you know, then that process, that manifesto effectively either gets, well, it does get ripped up. Some parts of it might go into the island plan, well, what we've called the island plan, but into the next programme for government. It may actually look like a different programme for government. So I think, you know, that's where I would probably point to as a critical juncture that needs more substance. If we, you know, we don't have room on the island for political parties, certainly, given whatever's available for political parties.
I disagree.
But, well, it would seem, of course, democracy hasn't been, I think, substantially tested on that issue for some considerable time. But, you know, certainly, I think, talking to a lot of people, including constituents, that wish for sort of one dominating party is not necessarily there on such a small island. Nevertheless, you know, we are in a position, I think, where a lot of people feel and believe that democracy is not delivering for them, and therefore I think we should be acknowledging that and seeking that improvement. So I, you know, would say, if you look at the process that's involved, if the House of Keys, for example, put in their trust in one individual to be the chief minister based on a manifesto, and yet that manifesto may or may not be the absolute document for the next stage, is potentially something I would say is challenging from a democratic perspective. And therefore, actually, you know, when you put it the way you have, and I've answered the way I have, you then say, well, actually, shouldn't you give that person some more ability to influence and justify, in the right circumstances, under the right caveats, with everything else, some of the decision making that is taking place.
Okay, last one for me on this. Towards the end of debates, like, Mr. Thomas has a habit of throwing in interesting remarks, things that have been quoted elsewhere, but are usually Mr. Thomas quoting himself. One of the ones that came up very recently, I think, in the last sitting, he said something along the lines of, it's been said before that the Chief Minister is a prisoner within his own Council of Ministers. He normally does this right at the end of a debate, so you never get a chance to respond, and I just thought I'd give you the opportunity, if you wanted to, feel no obligation to, if you wanted to respond to that kind of assertion, because in the context of the role of the Chief Minister and the role of the Council of Ministers, it feels apt, I suppose, to give you that opportunity, but feel free not to.
That's not a good description of collective responsibility at all. I mean, I think, like everybody else, and I've made it clear to everybody, we all make consensus decisions, as you will know, Mr. Hooper, in terms of, you know, things that always go our way. Absolutely, they're not always perfect, but, you know, we have a duty and responsibility when you take on roles as minister for service as well, and part of that service is ensuring that we also conduct ourselves and deliver a stable government. I think that's one of the things the island is renowned for. But like everybody else, if that collective responsibility means I resign, if I have lost faith in that policy or in those policies collectively to deliver the right outcome, and that's purely and utterly my responsibility, and that description is just that could apply to any chief minister at any point. Effectively, we, you know, we operate collective responsibility, we also operate consensus, and the makeup of that consensus at times, I'm under no illusions, it's tricky, it's difficult, it's not always easy, but, you know, it isn't even for a prime minister in charge of a party with a substantial majority. So, you know, within a party that has many different collective views. So no, absolutely not. I lead in terms of chairing the council ministers, delivering on those policies, supporting those policies until such a time as I felt they were no longer in line with my views, in which case then I have decisions to make.
Yeah, structural government. There's a lot of talk. I mean, for 4.5 years, it seems to be the thing that most people say to me about the growth of government or the size of government and the size of the civil service. We've spoken about it in the past, and I think you told me then that actually the numbers aren't going up as people perceive them to be. But your basic question, is the government too big?
I have tried personally and with the Cabinet Office to try and get clarity, because I think it is important that you look at where the areas of growth have been rather than just say the whole of government has grown, which is correct, but predominantly, I've said this many times, the core of growth has been health, education and home affairs. Actually, I think if you analyse that against the whole rest of government, you would find the rest of government had actually shrunk in numbers, and those three areas have provided that substantial growth. I think absolutely a government needs to be on top of its capabilities, deliver within its financial envelope, and in other words, within the finance that have been provided, but more to the point, constantly challenging itself as to the value for money that it is delivering. And I think you have to remember also, you put that alongside a government that is delivering trams, trains, buses, Gaiety theatres, villa marinas, all sorts of other items and businesses that perhaps would not necessarily be found in another small government. So, you know, there's been lots of challenge around this. I think we are trying to ensure that we are delivering efficiently as possible. There are opportunities to digitalise. We all recognise that, and we are trying to pursue that programme. The other thing I would just say within a context is that, you know, as a government, we are putting together legislation, we're putting together policy, you know, people are having to write that legislation, we're having to bring all that through, we're having to do our own analysis of finance, of economics, we've got our own regulators. You know, the government has a very wide necessary mandate in terms of the island, but of course we need to be, you know, on top of those services and looking for value for money and in each and every one of them. I think that's the size of government. In terms of the structure, I'd go back to the point that I made before, and I think it is worth continuing to look at how government is structured. I think single legal entity clearly keeps flagging up in all this. That is quite a complex subject in terms of change and what would be needed to undertake to change, and would also potentially drive at some of this necessary separation of powers. And naturally, even within the executive itself, there are parts of the executive that are needed to challenge the other part, the executive by statute. But there is continued questions about how effective it is from particularly from an operational effectiveness, running the system under 9 separate departments.
Well, I've answered when people have asked me about the size of government and the fact that it's too big, got far too many pen pushers. I've made the point that, you know, we live in a very different world these days, and actually a lot of the roles that didn't exist maybe 10 years ago are now almost mandatory to do the job that we do. But if we had another VAT problem with the UK and they halved our VAT share, we would have to reduce the size of government and the size of the civil service. Would it take that kind of a disaster for us to get on top of this?
Well, you operate to your means, don't you? And so basically that would have to happen. I think what that would mean in terms of then service delivery and what the outcomes would be on people's lives is very difficult to tell at this point. Clearly, you would look to dismantle those areas you think were the least important, or outsource or privatise or corporatise. I think that my experience of this, having gone through SAVE programmes, having gone through an efficiency programme, is that, you know, yes, there continue to be areas of operations within that government estate, if you like, the overall functions of government, which could be delivered in an alternative way. The political appetite for change has constantly been thwarted, and I go back to 2006, perhaps even earlier, with the first change programme that came forward, and the title of that momentarily escapes me, but we saw two versions of that. We've seen a SAVE programme, and now we're doing things slightly differently in terms of the way we are focusing on digitalisation in order to save the money, and I hope mean that will save the jobs as well as doing things like bringing in recruitment control frameworks as well. But we have to keep working at it. But a substantial change in terms of budgets would clearly mean that the government and Tim Ward would have no choice, I suspect, but to make substantial changes to service delivery.
That was Chief Minister Alf Cannon talking to Standing Committee of Tynwald on Constitutional and Legal Affairs and Justice members Tanya August Phillips, Stu Peters and Laurie Hooper. So what do you think? Is the Chief Minister right to seek more power for his role? Perhaps you think that better use of existing powers might be all that's needed. What is clear is that most of us don't appear to have confidence that government can solve the island's woes. For now, I'm Phil Gorn. Gura mai os ungeistach. Thanks for listening.